For training to work, one of the ingredients is it has to be sustainable. The training process, whether you're a world-class athlete or whether you're a recreational marathoner, it takes time. And I think that's where things go wrong for a lot of people, is that transition from the couch to, you know, their first 10K or whatever it might be. They push too hard too early.
Exercise physiologist, Dr. Stephen Saylor.
Now, it's important to have a work ethic. And in a sense, the pain means, yeah, we got to put in the work. But it doesn't mean that you're literally in pain every day. Because if you are, you're doing it wrong. We have a famous scale we call the Rating of Perceived Exertion, RPE. It was developed by a Swedish psychologist named Gunnar Borg. So it's the Borg scale. What we've learned from elite athletes is that you can't go hard every day. It's maybe the opposite of what we would have thought. Three basic zones. Green, I can be there for a long time. It's comfortable. Yellow, I'm turning on a stress response, but I can maintain that level of exertion for many minutes or even over an hour. And then that red zone where we start measuring things, you know, time almost feels like it stands still. You're counting seconds. A big reason that we have zones is to manage.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. If you have an interest in all things health, well-being, and self-improvement, you are in the right place. I publish two new episodes every week, one on a Monday and one on a Thursday, where I talk to the world's leading experts to help me explore the subjects of health, well-being, and self-improvement. So if that is your thing, and if you've not already done so, please like, subscribe. It'll take you 2 seconds and is absolutely free. And share with other people. Give other people the chance to enjoy the content on this podcast who want to learn and improve themselves too and find out all about their health and well-being. And do leave the podcast a positive rating. I think we're up to 4.8 out of 5 now on Spotify. And you can leave a positive rating on iTunes and on Spotify if you think I have earned 3, 4, 5 stars, whichever you choose. Now, today I'm joined by a person of serious interest and an expert. If you are someone who is considering your first couch to 5K run, or you have been training regularly for years, today's guest will certainly pique your interest. I talk with exercise physiologist Dr. Stephen Saylor, who has spent years studying the world's best athletes so that we can gain more knowledge about how the human body responds when we exercise and what we can do in order to achieve peak performance. We talk about what physical fitness means and why it means different things to different people at different stages of life. We hear the reasons why younger people enjoy an innate level of fitness in comparison with older people. And when I say older people, I'm talking people as young as 35 years of age here. We talk about how women who exercise must also contend with the complexities of their menstrual cycle. Expect to learn whether incorporating high-intensity interval training into your fitness regime is a good idea or not. We ask what VO2 max, heart rate variability, and lactate threshold are, and whether using a sports watch to measure heart rate is advised. Plus, we hear about the different zones of training and how knowledge of these zones, even if you are only a casual exerciser, is valuable to you achieving your fitness goals. Well, Dr. Stephen Saylor, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. You are an exercise physiologist who has spent years and years studying the world's best athletes. And is knowledge gained by studying these people at this elite level applicable to regular people listening and watching this podcast today?
Well, I can definitely see how that question would be something that we would ask. But my experience is that, yeah, it really is a good way to understand human function for several reasons. One is that, you know, the athlete is testing and developing their physiology every day. And not only the athlete, but thousands of athletes. It's kind of a huge experiment that's going on and has been going on for decades. You know, we could date it back to 1,000 years, or we can say, well, it really got serious after the Second World War, and after sport became quite, you know, almost a proxy for shooting each other, that we could battle each other on the pitch and on the track and that, and the Olympics and world championships. And so then this becomes this Darwinian crucible of development. So elite athletes have had to experiment with their coaches and figure out what works. And for it to work, for training to work, one of the ingredients is it has to be sustainable. It has to be a process, because the training process, whether you're a world-class athlete or whether you're a recreational marathoner, it takes time. And so you have to stay healthy in order for time to work. And so you can think of it as, I think I've used the analogy of the F1 series, the Formula One race cars, and a lot of major automobile companies are involved in the F1 series. And it's not because they just want to give us lots of laughs and giggles and, you know, and excitement. They're using it as an innovation arena. They spend a lot of money in F1, but they get it back in the form of innovations that do scale down. And we see the buttons on the steering wheel. We see the anti-lock brakes. There's lots of things that are now in every car that is sold by most car companies that started in F1. So innovation scales down. You don't ever see anybody take the family MGB or Ford and say, well, we're going to scale that up to an F1. And similarly, we see that research on training of untrained people, there's hundreds of studies on training, you know, 6-week training or 8 weeks of training for people who've been sitting on the couch. And pretty much anything you do, if you haven't been doing anything, looks like it's really effective. Okay? But it doesn't scale. Once you get past 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 3 months, it's no longer scaling. It's no longer effective. It's no longer working the way it should be. And I think that's where things go wrong for a lot of people, is that transition from the couch to, you know, their first 10K or whatever it might be. They push too hard too early. So that's a kind of a synopsis of, surprisingly, what we've learned from elite athletes is that you can't go hard every day. It's maybe the opposite of what we would have thought.
Well, can we talk about a term that most people will be familiar with, and that is the term physical fitness? I know it's a term that you were musing about on Twitter about a week or so ago, because physical fitness will be different for different people at different stages in their life, and then by extension, the optimization of that physical fitness will be different. So could you talk to us about this?
Well, yeah, I think one of the ways of thinking about it is when we're young, we get a lot for free, in the sense that, you know, you can make a lot of mistakes, you can be kind of lazy, but you still have a fitness reserve. You're built in with a certain capacity reserve. Just the process of getting through puberty successfully without killing yourself, if you're a young male, you know, doing something stupid, ends up giving you quite a bit of capacity. I was just looking at an article on just, you know, pubertal development and physiology. Our physiology just gets better, you know, fast in those early years. So we get a lot for free. You can get out of shape, but you still can, you know, jump up, sprint, do whatever, and you're not going to pay a big price for it. But then as we get older, you know, we're already starting to feel it. You'll hear guys in their 30s, mid-30s start to say, it's not quite as easy as it was, you know. And by the time you get to my age where you're pushing 60, you are definitely feeling that reserve you had, your room for error. You know, if you take off without warming up, you'll pop an Achilles or whatever. So the price you'll pay for mistakes is bigger because you don't have that fitness reserve. And by the time, you know, if I look into my future and project forward, you know, 10, 15 years, and now all of a sudden I'm in my 70s, well, now health and performance, I would argue, kind of come together, because health equals performance in the sense that for me to experience that I still have physical autonomy, that I'm able to do the things I want to do, be able to play with my grandkids when they come and so forth, I need a certain physical capacity. I need to be able to climb two flights of stairs carrying groceries. I need to be able to walk across the street quickly enough before the green light turns red. These are just, and that, so those become physical performance challenges, right? I certainly didn't think of them that way when I was 20. But probably if I'm lucky enough to live to 75, you know, or 80, they will be. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. So physical performance and health coalesce then as you get older, essentially.
I think so, yeah. I think that's a reasonable way for us to, and I'm not the first person to think of it this way. Others have written about this, is that, you know, we need to plan for our senescence. We need to plan, we need to think, what is it we want to be able to do when we're, you know, in our last decade, for example. I think Peter Attia has written about this and say, you better start training for it now, right? Is because if you wait until you're in that last decade, it's probably going to be too late. You won't have that capacity to do those things you want to do.
I spoke with a really inspiring man a few months ago on the podcast. He's an endurance world record holder. You've probably heard of him, Sean Conway. He had just completed at that point in time 105 long distance triathlons in 105 consecutive days. It was an astonishing achievement, I think, by any measure. And he had suffered an awful lot physically, as you'd imagine. But I asked him specifically about the pain. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, eventually you just forget all about the pain. And repeatedly, in that context, repeatedly we hear about the great athletes, the elites, are elite simply because they're able to have this unusual relationship with discomfort and pain, and that they're able to just absorb it and just get on with it. So I just want to hear your thoughts on the relationship between peak performance, performance optimization, and that relationship with pain.
Well, there actually has been quite a lot of research done on this topic. For example, there's been comparison studies made of, you know, East African runners, you know, Kenyan runners versus European runners, to see if they somehow have different perceptions of exertion at the same physiological intensities and so forth. And the answer has been no, that, you know, that if there's no, these better runners or do not seem to be better just because they have higher pain tolerance. We don't see that. Greg LeMond, who is a three-time, I believe, Tour de France winner, I think he's kind of famously quoted for saying, it never feels easier, you just go faster. And so I don't think we should somehow as non-elite feel like, well, the elites are just different because they don't feel pain. Oh yeah, they do. They do. The other thing about what's interesting about the elites is they say, well, I don't want to feel pain every day, because they can't. It doesn't work that way. It's not a sustainable process. The idea of no pain, no gain, which is what I grew up with in the United States, it's not true in a physical training context. It's a nice meme about it's important to have a work ethic. And in a sense, the pain means, yeah, we got to put in the work, but it doesn't mean that you're literally in pain every day. Because if you are, you're doing it wrong. As an endurance athlete, or even as a MMA fighter or a soccer player, or you can transfer, you can't be in pain every day, because then it's not going to be sustainable.
Well, that's a nice segue then to a discussion then about zones. I'm familiar with, I have one of these sports watches, and on this watch, it gives me five zones of activity, but I know you're a physiologist, and physiologists use three zones of activity. You were the person who came up or certainly adopted the 80-20 principle. So could you talk to us about zones of training and then this 80-20 principle, which I think you're further outlines what you said in that you can't be training to a degree of extreme exertion all the time because you will get injured.
Right. Or burn out. So intensity zones have a basis both in physiological changes but also perceptual. But if we take the physiological, we often talk about doing a lactate threshold test or a lactate profile. Some people will be familiar with. And traditionally, you would go into a laboratory and you would get on a treadmill or you would get on what's called a bicycle ergometer, which just means a work meter. And back in the old days, that was something that you only found in laboratories. Now, with modern technology, every bike is an ergometer because every bike you buy, if it's a road bike, you can get a power meter, right, on it. But so the physiology laboratory will have a way of having you do work at increasing intensities, whether it's on the treadmill, starting out at a really low jogging pace and then progressing maybe 1 kilometer per hour. Every 5 minutes, you go a little faster. But also every 5 minutes, you take some measurements. You measure the heart rate. You measure their blood lactate. You do a little stick of the finger and get some blood. And nowadays, we can get that measurement in a minute. And so we're in real time, we're making an assessment. And what we're looking for is a transition from a kind of intensity that we would often call it green zone. It's talking pace. It's comfortable. You feel like you can think about other things as you're doing it. You can get distracted by the pretty day or the butterflies or whatever. And time kind of just flows it for people who are reasonably physically fit. But then once you cross this threshold, the blood lactate starts to go up. So that's a marker that we measure. But there's other things are happening in the body. It's becoming, the work is becoming a bit more stressful. We're starting to turn on this so-called autonomic nervous system response, which we often call fight or flight. The body is recognizing that increase in intensity is saying, okay, I have to mobilize a bit now. This is not something I can do for hours and hours. It's starting to, I feel it. Blood lactate's higher, heart rate's higher, perceived exertion is higher. We have a famous scale we call the rating of perceived exertion, RPE. It was developed by a Swedish psychologist named Gunnar Borg. So it's the Borg scale. So we still use it today. It's 60 years old now. So we're using all these things to try to identify. First, we find that first threshold. We'll call that the lactate turn point one. We can also use ventilation because we'll start breathing heavier when we hit that point. And then we'll come into a phase that we often call this threshold range. And that's a range where, I've called it the yellow zone. Now you can still talk, but it'll be in short sentences because you're breathing heavier. You're feeling it. Your brain is starting to concentrate. You're starting to scan your own body at that higher intensity. You're no longer looking out at the birds and the bees and the flowers. You're kind of getting inside yourself and being a bit more introspective because you're having to focus. And then you can stay in that range. If you're well-trained, you can stay there for easily an hour, maybe even 2 or 3 hours for the really well-trained. That's where they're right in that area in a marathon on the lower end of it. But then we get to a second turn point, and that brings us into that red zone. And now time goes from we go from measuring them in hours to measuring them in minutes. Because now the athlete or the person is really working hard. And, these are those interval sessions, for example. Those are those times where you're in that so-called red zone. A lot of high lactate, really high ventilation, high heart rate, very high perception of exertion. So those are those three basic zones. Green, I can be there for a long time. It's comfortable. I can go straight to the dinner table after a workout. Yellow, I'm turning on a stress response, but I can maintain though that level of exertion for many minutes or even over an hour. And then that red zone where we start measuring things, you know, time almost feels like it stands still. You're counting seconds, you know, and minutes during those sessions. So those are those three basic zones. And then you can take the green zone and have a green and a dark green. You can take the red zone and have kind of a burn orange and a red. You know, you can split them up a bit, and then you get five zones. Okay. So those five zones can be pedagogical in the sense that it gives a bit more precision in the coach-athlete communication. I may say to my daughter when I was coaching her at running, I want you in zone four for this interval session, which means I want you at 90%, but not 100%. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So we use intensity zones both because of the physiology, but also because it helps us to fine tune the effort. Because again, now we get to the big reason for all this. I think it is it's two reasons. One, to a certain extent, the zones have a bit different effect on the body, a bit different signaling effect, a little bit different recruitment of muscle, different on the heart. But a big reason that we have zones is to deal with stress, is to manage the stress. Because every workout, we're trying to turn on some adaptations, but we're also going to have to live with some stress. The workouts stress our bodies in different ways. Mechanical stress, I mean, just the pounding on the legs for a runner, immune system depression, the big autonomic nervous system responses, all of this, you know, it has to be recovered from. Every workout does a bit of damage. We leave the workout a little bit weaker than we were when we started, you know, and then we recover. And hopefully, normally we recover within 24 hours and we can do it again. But those hard workouts, those tough ones in that yellow zone, those long threshold sessions or those red zone high intensity interval sessions, they take longer to recover from. Okay. So the recovery clock is longer than 24 hours. So now we've got a bit of a deficit, and we have to build that into our training. We have to make space for that recovery. And that is why we've seen that athletes, they self-organize towards this kind of 80-20 distribution. And what we're seeing is that, you know, roughly out of every 10 days or 10 big training sessions, 7 or 8 of them will be easy for them, meaning essentially green zone. And then a couple or three will be really tough, but they distribute, they manage their stress by choosing a lot of their workouts to stay at a fairly modest intensity, but go longer. Does that make sense? So they use the duration to get that signal they want, but they stay under I've called it the stress radar, you know, flying under the radar, not turning on that big sympathetic stress response every day. So that's a lot of physiology I'm talking about, but it breaks down to something I think we all understand in our daily life, is that, you know, if we're pushing kind of medium hard every day, that's a good way to grind into a burnout situation, right?
It's really interesting. There's a saying, certainly in the running world, that if you want to run faster, well, then you must learn to run slower for most of the time.
Yeah, and I think that expression has come, you know, we've come to understand it in the last decades by studying athletes better. Because it is somewhat paradoxical, you know, it sounds wrong, right? And I can even tell you, when I started talking about this stuff 20 years ago, I can remember the first conference I was at in 2004 in France, and I'm presenting to a mixed audience where there were national team coaches and then there were sports scientists. And as I was presenting this conceptually, what I'm talking to you about now, this kind of polarized training, I could see the coaches nodding in agreement. already then. Yeah, they said, yeah, of course this is true. This is what we do. You know, because they're the ones that figured it out. It wasn't the scientists. But then the scientists were kind of nodding their head the wrong direction. They're saying, this can't be right. You know, because they were used to doing 8-week studies of untrained people and training them at, you know, with intervals or threshold training and getting a good response in 8 weeks and say, well, that's what works. And we said, well, yeah, but training to become an athlete is not an 8-week process. It's an 8-year process or 10. You know, you with me? So this is, that's where it started. But now the sports scientists, we're all kind of in agreement. It's more about the details. It's like, how do we use the 20% more effectively? Or is there a way to optimize? You know, what's the best way to individually optimize the training? I think, so we've gone past the big disagreements on the basics. And now we're trying to use different tools to help our athletes optimize.
Does HIIT, high intensity interval training, does that make up part of the 20% that you're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. And don't get me wrong. Stephen Saylor is not he's not advocating a wimpy training process where there's never any hard training. And then you think you're going to perform really, really well in a 5K or something. That's not the case. You know, our best athletes in all the different sports we've looked at, you know, they are using interval training, but they're using it, what should I say, intelligently and carefully. Because it is it can be a double-edged sword. It can definitely hit us back if we use it wrong, if we use it too much. And a little goes surprisingly a long way with these training sessions. And we've have also, because of technology and that, we in the digital world where we can measure things really well, we've got some wonderful data, case data on, you know, some of the best athletes in the world that have occasionally got it wrong and had to make adjustments. And we've been able to see what happens when they just make some small errors in that intensity distribution. And it becomes, initially it works well. They've even won world championships. So there's a wonderful study on a Norwegian skier that's the greatest all-time female Olympian in winter sport. And she wins a world championship, and then but she's doing quite a lot of interval training, relatively speaking, and so it ends up becoming unsustainable. She shows performance declines, and she's about to retire. She just feels like, well, I've failed. Something's wrong. I can't do this. But then better heads prevail, and they kind of adjust her training, and she has 5 years that are the best ever. You know, she was just almost unbeatable. But that athlete was on the verge of retiring because she felt like she was not adapting to the training anymore. Her body wasn't working. But she just had to make some adjustments in her training. She had to get that balance right so that she recovered every day or, you know, better. We've learned a lot.
If we can just put that learning then into context then for people listening in. So let's say somebody has started running 5K, for example, and they want to decrease their time from half an hour to, I don't know, let's say 27, 28 minutes. How can they use interval training then? Can you explain exactly what interval training is in that context whenever this lady, for example, is trying to reduce her 5K time?
Yeah, I'll kind of flip it on you. I'll start at the start and say, well, you know, if I'm going to try to help someone run that 5K or 10K, maybe initially for the first time and then slowly get better, the first thing I'm going to talk to them about is say, well, let's agree on a frequency of training. Let's start at the start. And what we also have learned from the top athletes is one of the things that characterizes their success is they're able to train often. Okay. Now, often for an elite athlete is different from often for my mom or for me. But let's say I have this discussion and we agree on 3 days a week. I've got a busy schedule. I'm a leader at work. I have my kids playing soccer, but I can find time for 3 sessions a week. Okay. And then I'm going to say, now for the next 6 weeks, the only thing I want you to think about is getting out the door 3 times a week. I'm not really worried about intensity or duration I just want you getting out the door, if you're jogging, if you're cycling, whatever it might be. And then we're going to work on that for 6 weeks. And then we come back and she says, or he says, hey, you know what? I'm getting it done. I'm getting out the door. And in fact, I need it. It's becoming kind of, it feels like a habit. And I said, great, that's where we want it to be. You know, it's a positive habit. It's not feeling like it's a stress. It's feeling like something you want to do. And then I say, okay, we're where I wanted you to get after 6 weeks. Now I'm going to ask you this. How long, what are you doing in those workouts? How long are you going? Well, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Great. All right. What I want to do in these next 6 weeks is we're going to start stretching one or two of those workouts and trying to move towards an hour where your longest workout is 60 minutes. I don't care what speed, but let's get it out to 60 minutes over 5, 4, 5, 6 weeks. So you don't do it all at once, but just add 10 minutes to each workout, you know, or the at least one of the workouts each week. And in the next 6 weeks, we'll talk again. Okay. So then we get to now we're at 6 plus 6 is 12 weeks. That's 3 months where they've been running. They've been cycling, some doing something. They first got a habit going. They're doing 3 days a week. They're consistent. Consistency is a hallmark of success in elite performers. And now they're doing the second thing that elite performers do. They're using duration as a signal to help improve the adaptations, to get more out of the training. And it turns out that duration, you know, in other words, just going longer is a very powerful stimulus. There is a big difference between training for 20 or 30 minutes and training for an hour. Big difference. And then there's still a difference from an hour to 90 minutes, but that difference gets smaller. So it's a diminishing return. So now we've got some duration going. We've got a frequency habit going. We're consistent. And then that final piece on top of the pie or on top of the cake, the cherry, is intensity. So now I'm going to say, okay, I want to bring in a bit of intensity one of those days a week. I know there's a hill on that route that you run, you jog, and I'm going to have you run up that hill pretty hard, you know, where you can feel it in your breathing, but you can do it. And then we're going to walk down the hill, kind of recover, ease up, breathe out, and then we're going to run up it again. And we're going to do that, let's say, 4 times. And that hill takes you maybe 3 minutes to get up. Okay? So now I'm going to let you push your body, push that. You're going to recruit more muscle. Your heart rate's going to go up. Your breathing's going to go up. It's going to feel tougher, but I'm not going to try to make you cook yourself. I want you to really feel like you're working. Okay? So now we're getting into that. We're going to push into that red zone a bit and use intensity, because intensity also has power as a signal for adaptation. So now we're building this program that uses frequency. You know, it has to be consistent and sustainable. It uses duration, because duration does have a really powerful signaling effect. And it also uses intensity to get those stimuli that only intensity does really well. And so we're combining them as a kind of a recipe to help our, you know, whether it's the age group marathoner or whatever it might be, helping them to develop a sustainable program. Now, what's going to often happen is they're going to run that first 5K and they're on 3 days a week. And let's say it was 28 minutes. And they're going to want more. They're going to say, well, this was fun, but I think I can go faster. So what am I going to say then? I said, well, probably the best way to go faster, the easiest or lowest risk, highest reward, is just to add 1 day a week to your training. Let's go from 3 to 4 and see how that gives you even more consistency and frequency in that stimuli. You know, that would be the first step.
Such a comprehensive answer. There's so much value in that answer alone.
Well, you can't. I apologize for the comprehensive nature of it.
Not at all. No, it's perfect.
Look at it in isolation. You know, sure. The intervals don't mean anything,
sure,
unless you're doing the other stuff.
No, it's terrific. It's, as I said, an awful lot of value and knowledge in that. I think it's worth tuning into this interview for that answer alone. I mentioned already that I have one of these sports watches. I'm a triathlete, so I swim, cycle, and runs, and I do use this. Now, this comes with a whole load of bells and whistles, as you know, various different metrics. And I want to find out your stance on wearables and things like VO2 max and heart rate variability. For the amateurs of us out there, and I include myself in that, What are your thoughts on variables and all of these metrics? Is there room for it? Are they a distraction? Because I notice the elites rarely ever use these, particularly in races.
Yeah, it's a great question. I do a lot of work with technology innovation in training, and I teach some courses on it. But yet, if you were to look at my wrist right now, you would see there's no watch on them. And the only watch I still use is an analog watch I bought in the London Heathrow Airport. And it actually says TikTok. You know, it actually has that famous sound of the second hand going around, you know, which I like. So I'm very careful with myself because I think, like a lot of people, can easily get too, what should I say, distracted by all the bells and whistles, the technology. And so I use it very judiciously. Now, I train a lot indoors just because it's effective and it's kind of a laboratory. So I train on something called Zwift, which is a cycling application. And I get power every day. Every one of my workouts, I've got the full power, and I always wear a heart watch in my training. So those are my two basic feedback variables. I know how hard I train and how long, and I know what the heart rate response was. And then I have obviously my perception. Occasionally I'm playing with a variable that allows, or a wearable that allows me to measure my breathing. Breathing frequency turns out to be a really useful variable, but I think, and we're working on that, but I would say that I am very careful. I don't measure my heart rate variability. I don't measure my sleep quality. I don't measure a lot of these bells and whistles that those watches say they can measure. Now, heart rate variability is something that the heart watch can actually measure. But a lot of the derivatives thereof, like your sleep, your readiness to train, your recovery, all of that are bells and whistles that are not measurements. They are estimates. And they are full of error. And so, and Marco Altini, who has even developed his own heart rate variability application, it's very good. He would say that, he would be the first to say that, is that these devices measure one or two things, but they try to estimate lots of things. And we get pulled in by all the estimates, but they're just slightly better than guessing often. So we should be very careful. If I close this little commentary with this, I'd say what we're looking for is what fighter pilots also look for, is a heads-up display. They need to keep their eyes focused forward, not looking down at their watch or the data, you know, all the different instruments in the airplane. So they have certain variables, critical variables that are on their display that are kind of flashing up on their visors so that they can keep their head in the game, looking forward so they don't fly into a mountain. But at the same time, they're getting data on key variables. How much fuel do they have left, for example? What's their altitude? Well, I think that's kind of what we need as athletes, whether it's amateur or professional, is we need a heads-up display. But we don't want there to be more variables than necessary. That makes sense?
Terrific. No, it does make sense. And I find myself, when I'm at the tail end of a race, the watch really tends to go out the window as far as relevance is concerned. And I really just go on feel at that point. So,
yeah. Well, and that's, I think in the end, that's your biggest and best tool. I mean, it is your best variable is how am I feeling? And hopefully that becomes really well calibrated. And you can use your heart watch, or you can use blood lactate occasionally, or whatever it might be, as a calibration device to help calibrate your most important feedback tool, and that's your brain. You know, the best athletes, you know, good grief, world records have been set by runners who never used any of this technology. So we know it's possible. In fact, for them, they would say that's the way it should be. They need it. They need to have this, the brain, as their best feedback, you know. So that's my advice to people, is put on those watches, but occasionally, number one, don't look at them too much, and number two, maybe sometimes go out and run without them, or cycle, or whatever you do.
Which would be unconscionable to some people, I know. I can tell you that for sure. But it's great advice. No, I agree completely.
Or at least, and I would probably be one of them too, because I'm so used to, like I said, all of my workouts are registered. But at least those easy workouts, those long, easy, you know, where you're just putting in the time, I don't want to be looking at the heart rate. I want to be listening to some music or listening to a podcast, or, you know, I want it to feel comfortable enough that I don't have to zoom in and think about, you know, how are my legs feeling right now? If I'm thinking that, I'm probably going too hard.
I'm very interested to get your thoughts on female athletes and how they have to contend with the complexities of being female and having the menstrual cycle. I spoke with a terrific doctor down in New Zealand, Dr. Stacey Sims, a few months back, who specializes in this area. And we know about hormone fluctuations and temperature fluctuations across the month, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on whether is any recent research done on how those fluctuations in temperature and hormone levels affect elite athletes, and what we can learn then from those elite athletes and apply to a regular female athletes at the amateur level.
Right. Well, that there are a lot of issues that are packed into that question. But I would start with saying that, yes, there are some fundamental differences between male and female athletes. But the basic training recipe, the basic, you know, success criteria, intensity distributions, even the volumes of training are essentially the same. And an interesting study that was done here in Norway that I was involved in was interviews of 12 coaches, I would call them elite coaches from Norway. All of them had in common that they had trained world champion or Olympic champion athletes, male and female, in endurance sports. So they were, you know, if there's such a thing as an elite coaching group, they were an elite coaching group with years and years of experience in rowing, cycling, cross-country skiing, running. And they were asked kind of a semi-structured interview process, and there were questions around this issue of, well, how do you optimize training for female athletes? And what they said as a group, independent of each other, was they said, look, the differences between the athletes, in terms of how we try to individualize and optimize, the differences at the individual level are far bigger than the differences as a function of gender, as a function of are they male or female. So I think this is an important thing to remember, is that, you know, we shouldn't treat female athletes as somehow less able to absorb training or less able to absorb volume. That's just wrong. It's not, the data doesn't support it. The realities of these amazing athletes doesn't support it. But it is an extra variable that can add to that in the need for individualization. And there will be female athletes who will say, look, when I am in my menstrual cycle during the bleeding phase or right before, I have cramps, you know, I hurt, and that's not a good day. Those first one or two days, that's not when I want to be doing an interval session, you know? So they'll, if they're communicating well with their coach, they can talk around these things and move an intervals, move a workout a day forward, for example, or, you know, push it a day or two. Those are the kinds of adjustments that are made, it seems. And the way they get made is by coach-athlete duos having good communication, trusting each other. And the female athlete, if they have a male coach, that can often feel uncomfortable at first to talk about these issues. But it is, that's a success criteria, I would say, is that they get past that. And that's what we hear from the top coaches. It's like, hey, yeah, we talk about it. If it's an issue, then we deal with it. But we have to communicate.
Is that a conversation between a female athlete and a coach that is taking place now that probably wouldn't have taken place even 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think for sure. And there's so much good work being done by great, excellent, you know, female physiologists. One of the things we have a problem with is we have this just historical imbalance in, you know, the sports science ecosystem, particularly those who would call themselves exercise physiologists like me. We tend to be men. We tend to be male. When I say tend to, I mean it's a huge, imbalance. Historically, the females that have come into the exercise science field have tended to pursue health-related questions or nutrition. Now, this is just, I may get run over, I may get pushed under the bus for saying this, but that's what the data shows from scholarly publications and who's publishing what, you know, male versus female. But now we're starting to see really good exercise physiologists that are women as well as being great physiologists, and they're taking up some of these issues, and we're getting better. And my male colleagues, we're also more sensitive to these issues because we've historically just kind of run away from it. And how do we do that? Well, we just recruit males for the studies. Then we don't have to deal with menstruation, right? We just say, well, we'll just recruit males. Well, we're not doing that anymore.
That's great news. I'm glad I asked you that. I just wanted to get your stance on that. As you said already, you're based in Norway. Norway seems to be going through a golden generation of success as far as Norwegian athletes are concerned. As I said earlier, I'm a triathlete, amateur triathlete, and I've admired the success of world champions, Norwegian world champions, Christian Blumenfeld, Gustav Iden. Then you have the already legendary, and I think he's only about 22 or 23, the Jakob Ingebrigtsen, who's won everything in athletics. And again, he's Norwegian.
Well, not everything. He's gotten himself beat by some British 1,500 meters in the World Championship.
It's only a matter of time, though, I think, before he cleans the board of all of the awards that are worth winning. And I just want to get your take on this. I presume you're sitting back admiring all of this success by these Norwegian athletes. But what are your thoughts about how they are achieving this? Because this has been asked in various quarters. I mean, what's their secret? What are they doing differently?
Yeah. Well, I've been here 30 years or 29, coming up on 30 years. So I was able to see a lot of it. And my first introduction to Norwegian sport was watching the 1994 Winter Olympics. But then I was still in Austin, Texas, finishing my PhD. And then as fate would have it, I met a Norwegian woman and ended up marrying her and moving to Norway, or first moving to Norway and then marrying her, and slowly came into Norwegian sport. And what they will say is that, look, we were amateurs, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, and endurance was part of the culture. You know, it was, you know, in the United States, people will ask, they're fascinated by the big, strong athlete, you know, how much do they bench press? But in Norway, the culture has always been about endurance. You know, there's respect for the enduring person, you know, that goes out on skis across, to the Arctic Circle or whatever. So it's in the culture to begin with, but they were amateurs. And then in the 1988 Olympics, they had a really bad Olympics. They only won a couple of medals. And that was a trigger for them to say, you know what, if we're going to compete against the best countries, we got to up our game. And they developed what was called Olympiatoppen. which was kind of like the, in, you know, we see it in the Australian Institute of Sport, we see it in Great Britain, we see it in the United States, the U.S. Olympic Center, you know, all the countries have kind of been developing themselves, they developed this talent development kind of process. Well, the Norwegians did that, and it gave a huge payoff. Already in 92 Olympics, the medal count went up. In 94, it was like the best games ever, and they cleaned house, and they have continued to clean house, not only in winter sports, but relatively speaking, they, for the size of the country, they do really well in endurance sports, both summer and winter. And why? What have they done? Well, one of I've asked the top people, you know, what's the success due to? It's not new. So the first thing I need to say is Gustav Iden and Ingebrigtsen, that this is not new. It didn't start with them. It's been going on for 40 years, at least. It has roots 100 years old, but you know, since say 88, 92, there's been a system for development. And it consists of one of the issues is a common intensity zone system. So that gives you a common language. Now the rowers can talk to the runners and the skiers can chime in and discuss with the cyclists. And that creates cross-fertilization of, you know, ideas on training. That seems to be a really important issue. There are physical meeting places in Norway where, you know, the national teams often come together in Oslo, and now we have regional talent development centers to bring them together at the regional level. That creates these physical environments for interaction, for training together, which seems to be a very positive issue. So those are two of the big ingredients, is creating common language, creating opportunities for crosstalk. And I think that a third is a very clear focus on avoiding early specialization. We don't want our athletes to get zoomed in on one sport too early. We want them to sample. I mean, my daughter, she tried everything from taekwondo to, you know, dance, running, handball, you name it. And she was a dancer for 10 years at the national and international level, and now she's a runner. But she had this, like most kids in Norway, this experiential kind of library, you know, everything, football, you name it. And that we think that's good for their motor development. It helps them understand tactics better because they get more experience if they're team sports athletes. So we don't want athletes to specialize too early, and that seems to be, the research supports it, and it seems to be part of the success of Norwegian endurance athletes. Very often you'll hear, like Ingebrigtsen, they skied. You know, a lot of our athletes that have these amazing Olympic records, they will say, yeah, but I was also doing something else when I was younger. I wasn't just a runner, I wasn't just a cyclist, I had to eventually make a choice, but I was doing multiple things. So those are three ingredients that we seem to see. They're not new, but then of course, Ingebrigtsen, Gustav, you know, triathlon was not a Norwegian sport. It wasn't, we were late coming into that party, but I think they've transferred a lot of that knowledge from these other sports and put it together in their own way and had remarkable success.
My second last question for you, Stephen, before I let you go, recovery and active recovery, how important are these, and how important is it to factor these into your training regime?
Well, it depends on what you mean by recovery. I think there are lots of recovery modalities, you know, everything from, you know, devices and massage, and that we probably don't have a lot of good data to say they are clearly effective. But what is definitely effective is getting enough sleep. It is getting enough to eat, you know, getting your nutrition right. It is being able to relax. It is finding the right rhythm in your training. And for example, I listened to an interview from Gustav Iden and Blumenfeld that had just, you know, won, you know, and done really well in a world championship event. And they said, look, we don't use any of these so-called recovery devices because instead, we choose to spend more time sleeping. You know, they said if we cut out massage and a bunch of other stuff, it gives us an extra hour a day to just sleep. And we find that that is the best extra recovery we can get. So that's their, that's the, straight out of their mouths. You know, now I'm not saying that none of these items work, but I think it is, again, often it's an issue of keep it simple. You know, the most important thing you need as an athlete on the recovery is get fluid up, you know, drink, eat, sleep, and make sure you're doing that in a sustainable way.
And then I suppose finally then for the amateur among us, as I said, of which I include myself in that group, what is one piece of advice that you would have for somebody out there who is an amateur and who is just ticking along, but they want to kind of step things up just a little bit? And let's say they're in their, I don't know, 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever it is, but they're just competing at that amateur level rather than the elite level. What advice would you have for them?
Well, you know, they're going to typically be training 7 to 10 hours a week, something like that. You know, so they're putting in some time. They're not training 25 hours, but they're training enough. But they will tend. The most common mistake they will make is that their training intensity will regress towards the mean. They will the easy sessions will tend to get too hard, and they won't recover well enough, and the hard sessions will be a bit, you might call it too easy, or the quality's not there because they're not fully recovered. So this regression towards the mean and every workout becoming kind of the same, you know, 45 minutes hard-ish type of workouts, that's the biggest error. And what we find is that in this amateur group training, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, even six, is if we can get them to just do what they're already doing, but with more discipline, where easy stays easy, that they have the confidence to not chase the squirrels, as we say. When someone runs by them or cycles by them on a day where they're training easy, they let them go. That is the probably the single best advice I can give to that, you know, warrior group that's in their 30s and 40s, is just do have intensity discipline, because that's what we see in the best.
So much great advice and so much value, and definitely something I'm going to revisit certainly throughout my training sessions in the coming weeks and months, provided I stay injury free, mind you. If people want to find out more about you, Dr. Stephen Seiler, where can they go?
Well, I'm on Twitter or X, which is kind of my forum to communicate with athletes and scientists. So it's kind of a nerdy sports science training forum. I have a lot of videos, or quite a few videos, on YouTube, so they can just use my name and go into YouTube if they're interested in some of that. And then, of course, if they're really nerdy and want to read the articles, then they can find that stuff on Google Scholar or ResearchGate.
Well, we'll pop your links into the show notes for this episode. For the moment, though, thank you so much. Really great conversation, and I very much enjoyed it. Dr. Stephen Seiler.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you enjoyed it, or indeed any of the previous episodes, and you've not already done so, please like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might get value from tuning in also, and do leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.